Greetings and rhinospherical vibroablations, my unilaterally forgulated listeners, and welcome to this November 2016 Science News Update. I'm your host for this pontifically adumbrated science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. My, my, but the world has changed a great deal since I last spoke to you. I hesitate to make comments on the new political milieu that we all find ourselves in now, but let's just say I hope that the actuality of global warming and evolution can be recognized by the new powers that be, whether their ultimate causes are understood or not, and that the importance of science be recognized as well as more than a financial device to make more money. Anyway, let's talk about science. I want to head myself off before I say more than I should. First story. Those regular listeners may remember last month I was talking about microbiomes and the obese and how there seems to be little evidence that obese people have different microbiomes. During my little talk, I made fun of several imaginary headlines that suggested that microbiomes have been connected with a whole series of health issues, including, is your microbiome making you a Nazi? Well, imagine my amusement when I came across this headline in the journal The Scientist, based on the work from the lab of Dr. Antonio Gonzalez of UC San Diego. And this is seriously what it was. Does your microbiome give you migraines, quote unquote? The original journal article was published in M Systems, and it suggests that the stunning migraines that affect 38 million Americans may be caused by their oral microbiome. Gonzalez says, quote, there is an idea out there that certain foods trigger migraines. Chocolate, wine, and especially foods containing nitrates. We thought that perhaps there are connections between what people are eating, their microbiomes, and their experiences with migraines, unquote. Gonzalez's team studied stool and oral sample metagenomes collected by the American Gut Project, which has supplied hundreds of bacterial samples from fat people, skinny people, migraine-ridden people, peeps who climb on rocks, tough peeps, sissy peeps, even peeps with chicken pox. Sorry, got carried away there. I suspect the older among you may recognize that. They measured the abundance of nitrate, nitrite, and nitric oxide reductase genes, and compared the values from volunteers who reported experiencing regular migraines with those who did not. While stool samples showed only moderate increases in these genes, oral samples showed significant increases in their prevalence in samples taken from migraine sufferers. They sequenced 16S RNA, and they found that those people with migraines had much higher levels of nitrate-reducing bacteria in their mouths than people who didn't get migraines. Further analysis indicated that the prevalence of these bacteria was driven by the host physiology. Green leafy vegetables, some yellow fruits, and cured meats are common sources of dietary nitrates. Humans rely on bacteria in the mouth to reduce them to nitrites, which can later be converted to nitric oxide, NO, in the blood. Nitric oxide offers important cardiac benefits by lowering blood pressure and improving blood flow, but it also has been implicated in severe headaches by mediating vasodilation. Gonzalez says, quote, we definitely think this pathway is advantageous to cardiovascular health. We now also have a potential connection to migraines, though it remains to be seen whether these bacteria are a cause or a result of the migraines, or are indirectly linked in some other way, unquote. Gonzalez now plans to look into correlations between bacterial expression of the nitrate-reducing genes and the level of circulating nitric oxide in the blood among patients suffering from different types of migraines. Gonzalez hopes that one day there might be, quote, a magical probiotic mouthwash, unquote, to keep these bacteria and their nitrate-reducing activities in check. But for now, he says that if you suspect that nitrates are causing you migraines, you should try to avoid them in your diet and see if you get better. Next story, dolphin proteins and deep, deep diving. Dolphins and other marine mammals can survive deep dives that provide vital organs of oxygen without causing damage. The same scenario for humans that would be lethal. During dives that can last as long as 90 minutes, marine mammals restrict blood flow to their kidneys, liver, heart, and lungs to shunt more oxygen to the brain. A new article from Dr. Michael Janich in the journal Scientific Reports entitled "Proteomic Analysis of Non-Depleted Serum Proteins from Bottlenose Dolphins Uncovers a High Vanin-1 Phenotype" suggests that a particular protein may be responsible for dolphins' ability to dive so deeply. Janich from the University of South Carolina is looking into the protective proteins that dolphins seem to have that may contain clues to treatments for age-associated diseases in humans. When marine mammals resurface from deep dives, oxygenated blood flow is restored without the deprived organs suffering any damage. However, in humans, the same phenomenon of hypoxia followed by reoxygenation, as experienced during a heart attack, a stroke, or acute kidney injury, causes the release of free radicals thought to damage human organs. Janich found that dolphin serum contains very high levels of an antioxidant protein called Vanin-1 that likely has a protective effect for the hypoxic organs. Janich is optimistic that their discovery could be used in future studies for the development of preventative therapies. Janich says, quote, "We attempted to analyze all the proteins at once rather than individual proteins at one time in a cell or a tissue or an organism. It's just like genomics. When people are looking at 20,000 genes and seeing if they are turned up high or low in certain disease states, we're doing the same thing with certain dolphin proteins during hypoxic stress. There are more than 100,000 protein variants, but each protein can be modified. We have more than 1 million different protein variants based on modifications." Unquote. Very high Vanin-1 was a novel finding. Excessively high Vanin-1 levels were correlated with decreased liver function in the wild dolphins, which suggests they may provide a protective effect in avoiding metabolic syndrome. The function of Vanin-1 is to make vitamin B5, and in doing that, it releases an antioxidant that's been shown to protect tissues from injuries like those that occur after the hypoxia and reoxygenation of diving and resurfacing. The researchers are now looking to see if their findings have true relevance toward human disease states. Janich finishes with, quote, "This is the first step. We wanted to ask what's different in an animal that can do something that would hurt a human, and they would do this every day. And can we take it back to human medicine?" Unquote. Let's continue. Something new. Dinosaur brains. We finally got one. Well, sort of. Dr. David Norman of University of Cambridge reported in an online Geological Society of London special publication last month that a chunk of petrified brain tissue discovered in a tidal pool in southern England is the first reported from a dinosaur. Norman says, quote, "The roughly 133-million-year-old fossil preserves the brain's wrinkled topology. There are pits and creases and folds. It's a little bit like your bed when you wake up in the morning. Somewhat crinkled and folded." Unquote. The fossil, a roughly palm-sized rock, includes bits of bone and the tough outer layers of the brain, the dura mater. A microscopic analysis revealed the brain's plumbing, tiny branched tubing, blood vessels, crisscrossing the fossil surface and penetrating what was once the brain tissue. A beachcombing fossil collector found the specimen back in 2004. It probably belonged to a herbivorous dinosaur, like Beryllium or Hypsilospinus, at least according to Norman, with a body the length of a mini Cooper, he says. Norman indicates soft tissue is unusual in the fossil record. The dinosaur probably tipped headfirst into a boggy swamp, where acidic water literally pickled its own brain. Later, minerals would have petrified the pickled tissue. Norman finishes with, quote, "The resulting fossil doesn't offer insight into the mind of dinosaurs, but it does provide remarkable preservation of a piece of the brain itself." Unquote. The next story of the evening is an astrophysics one, since you guys are probably sick of the biology stuff. Headline: X-rays appear to be trickling away from Pluto, even though the dwarf planet has no obvious way of making X-rays. Okay, given all the cool stuff that researchers learned about Pluto since the New Horizons spacecraft flew by last year in 2015, this discovery about X-rays is, well, surprising to say the least. As I understand it, for many comets and planets, X-rays are generated when the solar wind, which is a stream of charged particles from the sun, runs into the neutral gas atoms or the magnetic fields from these bodies. However, the environment around Pluto isn't conducive to producing X-rays, they say. First, the dwarf planet has no measurable magnetic field. Second, its atmosphere is very thin. And third, it's losing that atmosphere, what little atmosphere it has, at rates that are much lower than expected. Dr. Carrie Lice from the Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel, Maryland, reported the story in the Einlein Journal Archive on October 25th. Lice says, quote, "We naively thought Pluto might be losing its atmosphere at the same rate as some comets. We knew comets make X-rays, so we hoped Pluto did too. We believe that interactions between the solar wind and a tenuous tail of methane gas, hundreds of times longer than Pluto's diameter, might be the culprit for these X-rays," unquote. Lice used the Chandra X-ray telescope in 2014, and then three more times in 2015 to look for Plutonian X-rays. The telescope detected just 7 photons streaming from Pluto in a total of about 2 days' worth of observation time. Okay, frankly, I am not even sure what that means. Does that mean that Pluto produced 7 separate signals, or that literally this X-ray telescope was able to detect 7 individual photons? Either way, they detected something. Anyway, Lice said that even though it's a pretty weak signal, that it's still about 6 or 7 more photons than expected based on the New Horizons probe measurements of Pluto's atmosphere and the solar wind. The paper notes that the signal appears to follow Pluto across the sky. They detected X-ray photons on 4 separate occasions. The energy of the photons doesn't appear to match that of the background X-ray noise that peppers the telescope, so they think that the signal appears genuine. Lice concludes with this, saying, quote, "We understand that there's a bit of skepticism, so we're going to do some follow-up with a totally different X-ray instrument to verify our first findings." X-rays from Pluto aren't just a quirky detail about this specific dwarf planet. If other bodies in the Kuiper Belt ring of debris just past Neptune's orbit have atmospheres, then X-ray observations could help to detect them as well, unquote. For the next story, let's stick with this physics theme. Super solids have been finally produced. It took me a while to understand what a super solid might be, because it certainly isn't something that you ever come across in normal life. However, 2 teams of scientists have reported in the last 2 months the creation of this mind-boggling state of matter, which is both liquid and solid at the same time. Supersolids have a crystalline structure like a solid, but at the same time can flow like a fluid, a superfluid, which is a fluid that flows without any friction. The closest thing you'll find in the non-quantum physical world to that is glass, which is actually a liquid that flows incredibly slowly, but still flows. And at the same time, it's also a solid, as we perceive it at least. But supersolids go beyond that. Way beyond that. Research teams from MIT and the University of Zurich have produced supersolids in an exotic form of matter called a Bose-Einstein condensate. The MIT group reported their work at the end of October online at archive.com, and the Zurich group at the end of September at the same online publishing site. Bose-Einstein condensates are created when a group of atoms, chilled to near absolute zero, huddle up into the same quantum state and begin behaving like a single entity. The scientist's trick for creating a supersolid was to nudge the condensate, which is already a superfluid, into simultaneously behaving like a solid. The MIT and Zurich teams both created regular density variations in the atoms, like repeating crystal structure of a more typical solid. And that density variation stays put, even though the fluid can still flow. The new results may be the first supersolid ever created. The MIT scientists originally expected supersolids to appear in helium-4, an isotope of the element helium, and the same gas that fills balloons at children's birthday parties. Helium-4 can be chilled and pressurized to produce a superfluid or a solid. Supersolid helium would have been a mixture of the two states. Now, I find this story absolutely amazing. I mean, the idea of a supersolid is so strange because superfluid and solid states compete. And in most materials, atoms are forced to choose one or the other. But in a Bose-Einstein condensate, the two states can more easily live together in harmony, I guess. But I have no idea exactly how they're able to do that because, well, I'm not a physicist. All right. Last story of the evening. From early on in human evolution, rampant sex has brought nothing but bad news to humans. And it seems that this continues. We've discussed early Homo sapiens and Neanderthals interbreeding in podcasts over the last couple of years, and most of our discussions have been about the Neanderthal DNA that was left behind in our genomes even after 100,000 years. Because of these little tete-a-tetes, non-Africans still contain somewhere between 1% and 5% Neanderthal genomic material. Now scientists claim that Neanderthals gave our ancestors not just DNA, but a sexually transmitted disease as well. Well, lucky us! STDs from ancient hookups. Who knew? Dr. Ignacio Bravo reported in the journal Molecular Biology and Evolution that the human papilloma strain HPV16, which infects about 4% of Americans and can lead to cervical cancer, is about 500,000 years old and likely originated in Neanderthal populations or the Denisovans, another extinct human ancestor, which we've talked about here too. Yes, boys and girls, now you can blame the hookups of some ancient ancestor of yours for your STD. Bravo of the French National Center for Scientific Research says, quote, "Oncogenic viruses are very ancient. The history of humans is also the history of viruses we carry and we inherit. Our work suggests that some aggressive oncogenic viruses were transmitted by sexual contact from archaic to modern humans," unquote. Bravo and his colleagues obtained 118 full sequences of HPV16 from 5 different subtypes to assemble a genetic timeline that suggested the transmission of that strain went from Neanderthals, or Denisovans, to Homo sapiens. And the current prevalence of HPV16 corroborates that suggestion. The strain is virtually absent from populations of sub-Saharan Africa, meaning that Homo sapiens who migrated out of Africa more than 100,000 years ago must have picked up the strain from somewhere else. Yes, blame it on the Neanderthals. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care. Stay away from Neanderthals unless you want a social disease. Keep watching the Plutonian skies for X-rays. Happy Thanksgiving to our American listeners, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.